Washington Week, news and analysis. I'm Neil Strasser, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. From Oslo this week came the news that Henry Kissinger and his Vietnam War negotiating counterpart, Lê Duc Tho, would share this year's Nobel Peace Prize. News controversial in some quarters, but pleasing to the new Secretary of State.
The news of this award reached me while I was chairing a meeting at the White House in which we were discussing means to speed peace in the Middle East. Nothing could underline so much that the search for peace is never ended.
Indeed, by the end of the week, Kissinger was off in Moscow, seeking to avoid big power confrontation and bring the Middle Eastern war to an end, of which more later in the broadcast. But sharing the headlines at week's end was a confrontation involving the president and the Watergate special prosecutor, Archibald Cox. It was to avoid a constitutional confrontation, said the president, that he was agreeing to make available summaries of those taped presidential conversations and directing Cox to cease all court efforts to obtain the tapes or other White House material. There was doubt whether the courts would view the action as compliance, and no doubt in Cox's mind that the directive violated the full authority guidelines under which he took the prosecuting assignment.
The instructions are made in violation of the promises which the Attorney General made to the Senate when his nomination was confirmed. For me to comply with the instructions would violate my solemn pledge to the Senate and the country to invoke judicial process to challenge exaggerated claims of executive privilege. I shall not violate my promise.
In a news conference on Saturday, Cox amplified he would go back to the courts to call the alleged noncompliance to their attention.
One form of procedure would be to seek an order to show cause why the respondent should not be adjudicated guilty of contempt. I think it may also be possible and perhaps might be preferable to seek a further order clarifying any possible doubt resulting from the president's statement last night.
The presidential announcement Friday night had portrayed Cox as the only objector, and the chairman and vice chairman of the Senate Watergate Committee as accepting an arrangement under which Senator John Stennis, the veteran Mississippi Democrat, would verify the accuracy of the summaries. But for a time Saturday, there was confusion on that point. Chairman Ervin at one time in the afternoon said the agreement called for verbatim transcripts of relevant portions chosen by Senator Stennis and sent to the committee. He said he would accept summaries from no one. The presidential statement clearly had said that the president would prepare a statement and that the authenticity of this summary, it said, would be verified by Stennis. Finally, just before a scheduled news conference, Ervin said the White House had assured him that his, Ervin's, understanding was correct, despite the words used in the statement.
Just 5 minutes ago when I got here, I was asked to call the White House, and the White House spokesman assured me that his understanding and the president's understanding and my understanding were identical, and that the committee would be entitled to receive from Judge Senator Stennis the exact words.
Ervin called the action by the president wise and said the committee's access to the tapes was not the same as Cox's problems with legal prosecutions and the directive to cease trying to obtain the tapes. Ervin, commenting only indirectly on the presidential orders to Cox, noting that he had insisted on independence for Cox as prosecutor.
I think it would be a tragic mistake for the country and for the president for Mr. Cox not to continue in this position with absolute independence of action.
Earlier this week, Archibald Cox was busy prosecuting, announcing criminal actions involving corporate gifts to the Nixon campaign in 1972 and the Humphrey campaign in 1968. Cox also commenting on John Dean's plea of guilty to one count in the Watergate cover-up, saying there was no deal on sentence length, but there was an agreement involving Dean's cooperation.
We did state that this would be the only charge we would file with relation to the matter of the Watergate incident itself, reserving the right to bring perjury charges if any false statement appeared. And he agreed on his part that he would give us what information he could freely that would be in help in our investigation.
Dean, the former White House counsel, of course, was a principal in many of those tape-recorded conversations, which had earlier in the week begun to pose a small obstacle, at least, in the way of congressional confirmation of Gerald Ford as vice president. Democrat Edward Kennedy challenging Ford to say whether Mr. Nixon should obey a Supreme Court order in the case.
I think, in spite of other qualifications, that if Mr. Ford refuses to respond to that question in a clear way, which would clearly indicate to the Congress and to the American people that he recognizes the supremacy of law, and that is the law of the Supreme Court of the United States, then Mr. Ford should not be approved.
Ford, at week's end, said he supported the compromise offered by the president. But with a new controversy over that compromise, the effect on his nomination was uncertain. Congressional action in any case seemed unlikely before Thanksgiving. The former vice president, meanwhile, went on radio and television Monday night, Spiro Agnew again proclaiming his innocence of kickback charges, conceding only that perhaps he let his fundraising activities and his contract dispensing activities overlap.
Perhaps, judged by the new post-Watergate political morality, I did. But the prosecution's assertion that I was the initiator and the gray eminence in an unprecedented and complex scheme of extortion is just not realistic.
Critics were unconvinced, supporters perhaps strengthened in their beliefs, but there were many who wondered why the former vice president had made the speech. And in the meantime, there was the Middle Eastern war and the increasing Washington involvement in aid and negotiation efforts. President Nixon on Monday laying down the U.S. policy.
The policy of the United States in the Mideast, very simply stated, is this. We stand for the right of every nation in the Mideast to maintain its independence and security. We want this fighting to end. We want the fighting to end on a basis where we can build a lasting peace. But the policy of the United States is that of peacemaker in the area.
The role of peacemaker included the hurried dispatch of Secretary Kissinger to Moscow in the wee hours of Saturday morning at the invitation of the Soviet government, U.S. officials taking the invitation as a sign of progress, but emphasizing that no kind of peace proposal is yet down on paper. Standing for the right of every nation to maintain its independence and security involved in this case, correcting any military imbalance caused by Israel's losses and the mounting Soviet aid to the Arabs. The U.S. began shipping planes and tanks to Israel, sent some servicemen to facilitate their reception, but just those few dozen men and no more, so Defense Secretary Schlesinger insisted in an interview with John Meyer.
Could this become another Vietnam?
I cannot conceive of the circumstances under which it would become another Vietnam.
Mr. Secretary, isn't there a danger in sending these dozens of U.S. military personnel to Israel that they, for some reason, might be captured and then it would be necessary to send more U.S. personnel in to rescue them?
I think that that requires a degree of imagination. The military personnel are at Israeli airports well back from the front lines. It is very difficult to imagine circumstances under which they might be captured.
Arab nations began restricting the flow of oil to the U.S. and Europe, and on Saturday, Saudi Arabia's radio was heard announcing a total cutoff in exports to this country. The U.S. does not depend heavily on Arab oil, but the cutback was not likely to help what is already figured as a substantial heating oil shortage this winter, particularly if the weather turns cold. If there was anything hearth-warming this week, it was the news that food prices dropped last month, holding the cost of living to what passes these days for a moderate increase, 0.3%. Such the Washington Week, produced by Ellen Wadley. I'm Neil Strausser, CBS News.